Okay, well, what I'd like to do today is talk to you, tell you a story. And I've chosen a rather large, very broad topic. But in the end, I think I want to cover these 6 points. I hope I'll be able to get through them all. But at the very least, what I'd like to do is get in the form of a story down to the last point, which tells us something about how astronomy and astrophysics, the study of astronomy and astrophysics, has changed over the last 30 or 40 years, because that's embedded in the story that I want to tell. Okay, I'm going to talk about galaxy evolution. And if I'm going to talk about galaxy evolution, since I know not all of us in here are astronomers or astrophysicists, I should show you pictures of galaxies and talk about what galaxies are. So the first thing to point out is that galaxies come in clusters. And here we see a cluster of galaxies. And you can see in this particular cluster there are galaxies of all sorts of different types. We can measure distances and find out that these are all very, very close to the same distance. This is another cluster of galaxies. Here in this cluster, almost every point of light that you see is a galaxy. There are only two stars that I notice in this picture, this one and this one. And you can tell that from the diffraction gratings. Everything else is a galaxy. Now, the galaxies come in various types. Most of us, when we think about galaxies, think about spiral galaxies. And these are galaxies that typically have their stars oriented in disks. They sometimes have bar-shaped distributions of stars that seem to rotate more or less like solid bodies. At least the pattern of stars rotates like a solid body. And some of them have very long, beautiful spiral arms. One of the things that's important to keep in mind is that there are stars everywhere. That is, even in between the spiral arms, we're filled with stars, and it's only because we see the brightest stars that are concentrated in the spiral arms that they look the way they do. Other galaxies, other spiral galaxies, show evidence of lanes of dust, and we can be certain that they are dust from various kinds of measurements that we make. And the other thing is that they contain gas. A typical spiral galaxy contains about 95% of its mass in stars, maybe 5% of its mass in gas, and about 1% of the mass of gas is in dust, very typically. Now, if we take a look at, here's just a few more spiral galaxies, we can see that some of them, the spiral arms are so chopped up that we would hesitate to call these long spiral arms, but clearly we can recognize some spirality in them. Yes, oh, that's good. Dust, we understand from the way in which light is scattered from these particles, that dust typically is made of particles that are about 1 micron in size or less. And these contain refractory elements, sometimes magnesium silicates, magnesium oxides. And in regions where they're cold, they can contain ices, volatiles such as water, and ammonia, methane, and things like that that freeze out on the surfaces of the dust. And I would appreciate two things. If there are, please yell out as Lars did for something like that. And if I say anything that for which the proper question is, how do you know? Please ask that question as well. Okay, so. There are also another class of galaxies called elliptical galaxies. And elliptical galaxies are generally featureless galaxies, or apparently featureless galaxies, mostly devoid of gas and dust. We have recently found that about 20% of these galaxies do contain significant quantities of molecular gas. Molecular gas means 99.99% molecular hydrogen and 0.01% everything else. But this, we don't really understand what's going on. We know that we detect this. But the other important thing about elliptical galaxies, to the degree that these contain stars that are just have random distributions of velocities and positions, we can talk about these as galaxies that have lost their memory of formation. We have very little in the way of structural information that tells us from the galaxies themselves how they formed. However, we have other clues about how these things may have formed. Here's just another. This is the largest elliptical galaxy, which is relatively close to the Sun. This is the galaxy M87. This, in fact, has a jet of material which is coming from which a black hole is embedded in the center. Please don't ask me how we know there's a black hole. It'll take me a little bit of time and take me away from the story. There are also dwarf galaxies. These are irregular galaxies. These galaxies are typically found very close to the Milky Way and in a local group of galaxies, of which this M31, which is the largest spiral galaxy in our own group of galaxies, which is self-gravitating, held together by the mutual gravitation of the galaxies in here. And again, we can see these lanes of dust and a couple of satellite galaxies in orbit around this galaxy. If we take a look at the Milky Way itself, our own galaxy, through a telescope, as Galileo did, who was the first one to do so, we find that these galaxies, that our galaxy contains stars. So one might ask, how do we know that what kind of galaxy we live in? And that's because if we take all sky images in the infrared portion of the spectrum, so that we're looking primarily at light that comes from evolved stars, and this infrared light, because of the size of the dust particles, penetrates the dust much better than optical does, we see something that looks like another galaxy. This is a relatively nearby galaxy, NGC 4565. It has a bulge, as many of the spiral galaxies do, and a disk of material. The spiral part is always in the in this disk, and and so on. This I just point out this picture because this is my favorite picture of the Milky Way. And the way to think about this picture is this is an all-sky projection. You have to imagine that we stretch this image so that it completely surrounds us. So this is looking at the back, you know, we'd have to be looking through the back of our heads to see this part and this part. Here is the bulge, and let me point out we have two large satellite galaxies that we see here. This is called the Large Magellanic Cloud and the Small Magellanic Cloud, which were first recognized by Magellan's navigator Antonio Pigafetta during his circumnavigation of the Earth. If those of you, can you all see this little tail of material that comes down here? You all see it in the back? This is, in fact, we've come recently to recognize that this is a galaxy. This is the nearest galaxy to us, and it is actually colliding with the Milky Way. This is known as the Sagittarius Dwarf, and this was discovered about 15 years ago.
Is that infrared image again?
This is infrared image, but this is an infrared point sources, so that we're seeing individual stars in that image all blended together. You really, if you do this in the optical, you don't get a picture that looks like that because you're blocked by the dust, and you typically don't see further than about 10% of the diameter of the galaxy. This is another. This is M33. This is another galaxy in the local group of galaxies. This is the other moderately large spiral. This probably has maybe 5% to 10% of the mass of the Milky Way. I showed you a picture of the Large Magellanic Cloud. This is a nice picture. This is an irregular galaxy. stars are forming throughout this galaxy, and the Small Magellanic Cloud, which is both in orbit around the Milky Way and apparently in orbit around the Large Magellanic Cloud itself. These can't be seen from the Northern Hemisphere. You have to go, I've never even seen them as far south as Hawaii, and I've had to go down below the equator to get a good view of these. These two things are clusters of stars. These are not galaxies, and I'll talk about the difference between these in a moment. And these belong to our own Milky Way as opposed to this separate system here. Now, we have some dwarf galaxies which are now increasingly small in size, and up until a few years ago, we knew of about 20 companions, 15 to 20 companions of galaxies in orbit around the Milky Way. Generally, perhaps no more than about 0.1% of the mass of the Milky Way themselves and in orbit. And this is this Sagittarius dwarf that I showed you before, which was this little tail that was coming down from the center of our own Milky Way. Now, a few years ago, this galaxy was discovered in this group of 12 new companions to the Milky Way. This is called Leo T. And can you all see this group of blue stars around the middle? It's not so easy to see, but this is the brightest of the new galaxies that have been discovered. The first of this group of new galaxies, which is called Willman 1 after its discoverer, is here. Now, can you all see this obvious galaxy? If you take a look, and I'm not going to ask Marty to do this, but if we turn down the light, we can see some galaxy, some evidence of some increased amount of points here in the center. It's very, very difficult to see. And this is one of the fainter of the dwarfs, but if you take even deep images, it's very, very difficult to see some of the most recent galaxies that have been detected around the Milky Way. 2 weeks ago, there was we had some discussion here at the workshop, but there was a news release of a galaxy that was found that was only 350 times as bright as the Sun. Now, let's try and get some understanding about what that means. We talk about, in this particular business, we talk about things in a ratio of mass to light, where the units are mass of the Sun to the luminosity of the Sun. So if every star in the universe were exactly like the Sun, the mass to light ratio would be unity. Now, it turns out that the Sun is a little bit more massive than the average star, and about 5 to 10 times less luminous. So the mass to light ratio, typically of a spiral galaxy, or of the stars in a spiral galaxy, or the stars in a galaxy, like even these elliptical galaxies, is typically in the range of 3 to 5. And we're going to get some very strange numbers from some of these other galaxies that we see. So this most recent galaxy, which is called Segway 1, has perhaps only about several hundred stars in it. That when these stars become red giant stars and evolve as they do to become giant stars, that single star will be brighter than the whole galaxy itself.
Is the density of mass really just a percent higher than in the surroundings, or
not even? It's very much smaller. Everything that you see here, except for a few of these points right in here, are stars in our own galaxy, not in this other nearby galaxy. I just point this up not for you to see the galaxy here itself, because it's very, very difficult. Even you crank up the contrast in a darkened room, but we have good evidence that this is a galaxy, and I want to come back to this at the end about what we actually mean by a galaxy.
Yeah, that was my question.
Right, so but I'll try and get back to that.
What's the red and green line?
Probably satellites that have gone by.
So let me understand that. If we had an accurate three-dimensional reconstruction of the positions of the stars in this new galaxy,
yes,
this galaxy you're trying to point out here would be physically separated from our galaxy?
Absolutely. That's correct. Let me just give you a sense. Astronomers use the units of parsecs. Parsec is 3 light years. The best way to think about a parsec, it's about the average distance of between stars in the Milky Way, roughly speaking. So the Milky Way has a diameter of about 30,000 parsecs. This particular galaxy, I think, is at a distance of about 60 parsecs. I'm not sure. Maybe someone else, the astronomers, may remember. 60,000 parsecs, and the size itself is maybe 100 parsecs in diameter. So it's a clear entity. It's separated and from the galaxy itself, and from its we measure the velocities of these things from Doppler shifts in the spectra of the stars, and we can tell from that system is almost surely bound to the Milky Way, gravitationally bound, and not just a ship passing in the night.
Is it bigger than a globular cluster?
Yes, a globular cluster typically, and this is what I showed you, these two globular clusters before, are typically 5 or 10 parsecs in diameter. So we're talking about things which may have much less mass in stars than a globular cluster, but is about typically of the order of one order of magnitude, factor of 10 larger than a globular cluster itself. And we'll find out one very important difference as I talk about dark matter. So one of the questions is probably many of you are familiar with the quote of Huckleberry Finn. Let me see if I don't screw it up. When talking to Tom Sawyer, "Lordy, it's lovely to live on a raft. We have the sky up there all sprinkled thick with stars, and we used to lay on our backs and look up at them and discuss whether they was just made or whether they just happened." Jim, he allowed as they were just made, but I allowed that they happened. I judged it would have took too long to make so many. Well, one of the questions is, are galaxies just made, or did they just happen? And so I want to spend the rest of this time talking about a little bit about what we know about whether they was just made or whether they just happened, and how we know that. Now, why do we care? You know, were these born? Do we see a plethora of galaxy types and sizes just because this is the way they formed initially, or do they evolve from one into another? Now, that's of course a question of interest to astrophysicists, but why should anybody else care? And I think the reason, one of the particularly interesting intellectual reasons, is the following. If we take a look at the density of matter from one place to the next, from this desk to the air, you know, we have probably 3 orders of magnitude in density or more. If we take a look at the difference in density between the center of the Earth and the atmosphere around it, we have many, many orders of magnitude of difference in density. And in fact, if we think about the range of densities in the universe, we have material which is of nuclear density, that is, the density of an atomic nucleus in neutron stars. And we can compare that to the density of interstellar space, and we're probably talking about, I didn't work it out before, but probably something like 60 orders of magnitude in terms of density. Maybe Lars knows the number off the top of his head, but it's something enormous. But 45? Okay, well, that's close to 60 anyway. Astronomically speaking. Okay, when we take a look as far back as we can, which is when we make images of the radiation which became decoupled from the matter, which we talk about as the microwave background or the 3-degree microwave background radiation, that radiation tells us something about the density contrast of matter when the universe was about 400,000 years old. That density contrast was 10 to the minus fifth. In fact, it took years before one was able to see any density contrasts in that matter at all. It was, and in fact, it's one of the reasons we know what it is. The fact that it's so smooth, that it comes from everywhere, is one of the things that tells us it must be cosmic in origin, and its temperature and smoothness and its isotropy tell us that it is of cosmic origin and left over from the Big Bang. Okay, so the question is, how did the universe get from a place 400,000 when it was 400,000 years old to its current age of 13.7 billion years? How did this density contrast increase from 10 to the minus fifth to this 10 to the 45 number that we have currently? That's 50 orders of magnitude, and that's an enormous increase. And the answer, part of the answer, is gravity, and the other part of the answer is dark matter. So let's talk a little bit about dark matter, what it is, how we know it's there, and what its effect it has ultimately on the formation and evolution of galaxies. The first, when I think about dark matter, we can think about it as having several different definitions, but one is, I think about it as non-luminous matter, material that doesn't emit or absorb light, that is detected by means of gravity. And the first evidence for dark matter in the universe was made by an astronomer named Galley, a German astronomer, in the 1840s, who first looked for a companion, or not a companion, but for a perturber, which was perturbing the orbit of Uranus. And there was a prediction made by Le Verrier, the French astronomer, the year before. And the first night he looked, he was able to find this, that it was in fact a planet. It was luminous. It was Neptune. But this prediction that there was something there that we couldn't see, this was the first one. There were others. The prediction, the measurement of a star, the perturbation of a star, of Sirius, the planet of the star Sirius, a very bright star in the night sky, by a white dwarf companion, was measurable in the 1840s and later found. Now, there have been several predictions that there was material that was non-luminous in the Milky Way, starting in the Milky Way and in galaxies, starting in around in the early 1930s. The first was by the great Dutch astronomer Jan Oort, who said, found that the motions of the stars in the plane of the Milky Way, that is, that the stars move up and down and all around, the degree to which they reach a certain height and their velocities is indicative of how much matter there is in the disk. And we add in, when he added up all the matter that we knew about there, and tried to compare that to the stars, he found that there wasn't enough that could be seen. And so he attributed this to dark matter, and this was matter, in fact, he used the term dark matter, which I forgot what it is in Dutch. But later we found that, and he knew at the time that there was interstellar gas and dust. This was before the detection of atomic hydrogen. This was even before the clear detection of identification of dust in the interstellar medium. But nevertheless, he postulated that this material was there, and it was later found. The same year or the year after, Fritz Zwicky, a Swiss astronomer, known for his irascibility, and he is, well, he was a maverick. Pissed a lot of people off, but that's another story. He measured the motions of the galaxies in a cluster, the Coma cluster, and he found that these things were moving much too fast. Their velocity dispersions was much too high to be explained by the amount of matter contained in the galaxies themselves. So he also talked about dunkle materie, that is dark matter, used those words. And he, however, in later papers, also attributed it to ordinary matter that let me see if I can get back. Ordinary matter that was not yet detected. It was later confirmed, although his measurements needed to be refined. He found that one needed 400 times as much matter as could be seen to account for the motions. And in fact, the correct answer is more like 50 times as much. But nevertheless, the basic idea is the same. And we now understand this kind of matter to be the kind of dark matter that we see. There were a couple of other indications for dark matter in the Milky Way. But in the early 1970s, it became clear that something else was going on. There were indications that started out from theory that to be able to keep galaxies flat, that is, to keep them from buckling and keep them flat, they could be stabilized by a halo of material, a spherical halo of material. This is what I attribute the first modern detection of interstellar, first prediction of dark matter. But the most important came from the following. If one takes a look at one of these galaxies, and let me just take a spiral galaxy, when we have the major axis of this galaxy, the galaxies tend to be inclined, the major axis of this galaxy is always an axis where the motion is moving either directly towards us or away from us. And from this, from the gas in these galaxies, we can measure the velocity of rotation. And typically, we get what are called rotation curves from these galaxies. And in a typical spiral galaxy, a rotation curve, what happened in the 1970s was were two things: improvements in instrumentation and for looking in with ordinary light telescopes, and improvements in radio interferometry to look for the 21 centimeter line of atomic hydrogen. And one found rotation curves that look like this, where what we're looking, a rotation curve means this is the radius, the distance from the center. This is the center, this material is going out, and this is just the velocity. And essentially all spiral galaxies had rotation curves that look like this. But now, if you remember from the pictures of the spiral galaxies that I showed you, what happens is when you get to the outskirts, there's less light. The light slowly falls off in an exponential fashion. And so if the amount of light that we see there is proportional to the amount of matter, one predicts that one would get a rotation curve that looks like this. Should be falling. That is, there's less material to pull this around, so it falls off. Eventually, in the form of Keplerian orbits, the way we see in the solar system. Because this was the case around every galaxy, it had been postulated that galaxies themselves, individual galaxies, contain dark matter. Now, at the time this was done in the 1970s, it was the case that we didn't know about things, they were postulated, brown dwarf stars. That is, stars that have so little mass that they can't ignite the nuclear processes that cause stars like the sun to shine. And so, again, it was thought at that time that this dark matter was material that was could it be in the form of dust or gas or something else that wasn't seen? But it turned out that in a galaxy like the Milky Way, one required about 5 times as much mass in this material as we saw in all of the gas, stars, and light that we see in the Milky Way itself. And so we can talk as the mass is proportional, in this case, if this thing is flat, to the radius. You know, the further out you get, the more enclosed mass that you have in these galaxies. This is what was concluded at that time. And it became quickly realized, because you need so much material, if it's in the form of gas, it would have been seen by radio telescopes. If it were if it were hot gas by means of its X-ray emission. If, on the other hand, this was in the form of dust, there's so much dust we wouldn't be able to see external galaxies. If it was in the form of brown dwarf stars, you would eventually see it by looking in the infrared and other portions of the spectrum. And so it became clear that by, I would say, the early to mid-80s, that this was unlikely to be in the form of gas, dust, stars, and that's ordinary matter. And it was around this time that the physicists began to take notice and say, hey, it's not ordinary baryonic matter, that is matter made of protons and neutrons. And furthermore, this is material which does not interact either with itself or with other, with ordinary matter, that it is probably made of some sort of particle that we don't know about yet. And so hence, many of the particle physics experiments, especially the ATLAS experiment at the Large Hadron Collider, is now going after some hints, direct and some indirect, to be able to find out what this dark matter might be. Okay, so we knew that it was in the form around individual galaxies. When we look at clusters, we knew from the time of Zwicky that this dark matter must be at least also in clusters of galaxies. And with the launch of the COBE satellite, that is the launch of the satellite that was able to measure the radiation from the cosmic microwave background, it became clear that this material was also distributed on a universal scale. And the most recent satellite that was launched to measure this, the WMAP measurement, has now made a very, very precise determination of how much matter and dark matter there is. And we know of the total budget of matter and dark matter in the Milky Way, in the universe, that is, that about 4% of all of the mass energy is in ordinary baryonic matter, and about 22% is in dark matter, whatever it is. Well, when it became realized that on a universal scale that this amount of that the dark matter dominated the energy budget, except for the now recently discovered so-called dark energy, that as galaxies formed, what was really important was what was happening to the dark matter. Because the ordinary matter, and much of this ordinary matter is not in the form of stars, it's in the form of hot gas, that is, that whose time to cool into condensed objects is so long that it would not ultimately form stars. So that the dark matter, as it is changing, will ultimately drag the luminous matter with it. So to understand the formation of galaxies, it became necessary to understand how the dark matter evolved over the course of the evolution of the universe. Okay, so there was good news and bad news here. The good news was that the only thing that really mattered was gravity, because the stuff didn't interact with itself. And so it was possible to make simulations of the formation of structure within the universe. And after people thought about it for a while, and when these simulations were done, what was possible to be done is to recognize that for something to change in density by a factor of 2 will depend on 2 things: how large the initial fluctuation that you have in the background is, and also how large it is. The smaller ones are going to be able to grow the fastest. And so one is able to make these fluctuations, and the fluctuations themselves, these matter fluctuations, could grow, and the biggest ones became pigs. That is, they became selfish and they would eat all the stuff that's around them. Right? And it's the story we have in our economy today. No matter what's going on, the rich get richer. And that's what happens, and that's what's happened in the universe as a whole. So it was possible to make simulations, and let me just show you of the dark matter itself, one that was made by a student of mine. And this is a simulation of the formation of the local group starting from a relatively late time. And what we see here, this is the galaxy, supposed to be the galaxy M31, our near neighbor. The Milky Way is coming in here. And you can see all these very, very small things forming. They combine, they grow. And the idea is these are just dark matter simulations. But these dark matter simulations show that we can make very clear predictions about what must be going on. And so the idea has been that these things will grow to a particular certain size, and they will bring the, let me get out of the way, they will bring the luminous matter, the baryonic matter, with them to form the galaxies.
What the initial condition was?
In this case, the initial condition, I can tell you, but it was wrong, because which is why this thing was never published. And the reason is that you can see that this ends at a z of 0.62, which is, it should be the end of a z of 0, which is now, and then give us the proper separation between the Milky Way and M31 that it doesn't. This particular simulation, I'll have to think about more specifically about the initial conditions, but it started out at a redshift of 100 and with a fluctuation spectrum, that is amplitude of the fluctuations and the fluctuation intensity, to be able to give us something that looked like it does now. We did many, many runs until we got something like this. When I say that this is the Milky Way in M31, this is what we talk about as a constrained realization, that is, that we constrained the initial conditions to give us something that would look like it in the end. Okay, let me just see what... okay. Now, I told you there was good news and there was bad news. The bad news is that the dark matter simulations are easy. And they are sufficiently easy that when we take a look at some of the dark matter simulations, and Julio and others at the meeting are people who do these simulations, we can count the number of small things which we identify with these dwarf galaxies and see if they're the right number, how many of them do we in fact see. And the answer is that we expect in a galaxy around the Milky Way to have about 1,000 of these objects with masses about 10 to the minus fifth that of the Milky Way itself. That is, where the Milky Way has a mass of 10 to the, let me write down these numbers because they're easy to forget. The Milky Way, the total mass of the Milky Way system is about 10 to the 12th times the mass of the Sun. And the Milky Way, the mass of things that are 10 to the 7th solar masses are greater, there should be about 1,000 of these things. Well, we count them up, and we see that, there are dwarf galaxies, and we count now with the ones that are discovered, the ones that have not yet been making corrections for the portion of the sky over which it was looked, we get maybe 60 to 70 galaxies, but we should be seeing 1,000, yes.
Does that include the effects of tidal disruption?
The tides are automatically put in here, yes.
In your estimate of 1,000?
Yes, there's 1,000 left over, taking all that stuff into account. Now, so that's a problem, but that's not the bad news. The bad news is that to make galaxies, we have to take gas, that is typically atomic hydrogen gas, we have to turn it into molecular gas, and out of that molecular gas form stars. Those stars then evolve, and the massive ones become supernovae, and they inject material back into the interstellar medium. They eject the carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen that we have in our bodies. As Carl Sagan most famously pointed out, that we're all star stuff, that the heavy elements in our bodies must have all been made in stars. And trying to understand what happens is very hard. Dealing with gases, we have to deal with not only the perfect gas law, but with hydrodynamics. And the most difficult part of all is magnetic fields, because these things are either fully or partially ionized gases. And to the degree that we can make measurements of these magnetic fields, the energy density is typically comparable to that of the other turbulence and the other fluid properties that go into making galaxies. So we have a much more limited understanding. Yes?
The simulation that predicts 1,000 quarks, is this only dark matter, or is it?
It's only dark matter, but, right? But I'm going to get to that, because that's an important part of the story, yeah.
To follow up on that, I mean, in this initial condition thing, I thought you picked the initial condition so it would satisfy those types of constraints.
I did in this simulation, but there are other much better, much more reasonable simulations where one starts. Of course, there are all sorts of initial conditions one can start with, but I would leave it to an expert, someone like Julio, who's done these things, to talk about that in more detail. I mean, you typically start out with a Gaussian fluctuation spectrum, and you...
The crucial thing, this is cold dark matter, so there's a structure on all scales.
Yes.
There are many, many more small scales than there are big scales, and therefore this is just, a representation of the initial conditions, but it assumes that that matter is cold, which is something that...
Right, and this... I was only going to mention it briefly because it takes us a little too far afield. That is that the dark matter particles that may make up the dark matter may have very small masses like neutrinos, because neutrinos were produced in the early universe in great abundance, but it's hard to get them to produce structures on small scales, on scales as small as the dwarf galaxies, which we see in great abundance. And so we think that these things are massive, and we can take them and have velocities of, I mean, effectively take them as zero velocity particles, isn't that right? Or something like that. Yes?
Sorry, what interactions are you assuming for the dark matter?
Gravity only.
And with itself, too?
With itself, but let me answer your question by way of a roundabout matter. Heather, come here.
What?
we're gonna show you what happens to the gas, right? And why it becomes, no. Now, one of the things that happens as gas collects is that it has some angular momentum and it starts to spin. So Heather, spin. Spin. Okay. Now we're spinning in more or less the same direction. Okay. And we can come together and continue. Wait, and continue to spin around. And so we make a wonderful pair spinning around. And if we were the gas particles, not yet, in a big galaxy, then we could form, as these galaxies emerge, some of the spiral galaxies. Now, let's spin in the opposite, which go in an opposite direction so you don't get dizzy, all right? Let me see, I have to... Okay, so now, wow, all right? If we're spinning in opposite directions, the gas, thank you. Let's give Heather a... The gas spinning in opposite directions now will collide with itself, and because the collision time, even between gas that is relatively rarefied, is short, for the time it takes two atoms in the interstellar medium, in the Milky Way, in the vicinity of the Sun, to collide with each other is 1,000 years. Now, on a cosmic time scale, that's instantaneous. And so what happens is that you cause these collisions, the atoms become excited, they give off radiation, they can collide with dust, and it can cool. So some of the cooling allows us to maintain angular momentum to be able to form large galaxies. In the case of our anti-angular momentum, we collide, you lose all the angular momentum, you give up all the angular momentum, and then what happens? Well, that material falls to the center. And so we can form different galaxies in that way, depending on what happens to the angular momentum of the stuff. And but stars don't collide. Stars are not self-interacting. They interact with each other collectively and individually only through gravity. But we can consider them to be a collisionless fluid. And the same thing is true of the dark matter. The dark matter, because it doesn't interact quantum mechanically, through photons and stuff like that, it will also not be able to collide, and therefore that's one of the reasons we can do this, because it's so simple. When people add gas to these simulations, we almost always get the answer wrong. Now, people are trying to do this, and this is not because valiant efforts aren't being made to add the gas. But Brand Robertson here has been talking about making simulations now that add, it's not only the gas. We know that the stars have to form not out of any gas, but of gas that is made of molecules only, because this gas is cold, and if the gas is cold, it can form instabilities of the size of an individual star. Hot gas forms instabilities only on much larger mass scales. So, and he's making good progress, I think, in trying to understand how to form galaxies that look like the ones that we do from his simulations. So there are several things that can form. One is that the kinds of interactions we have between dark matter particles, we can have what we talk about as minor mergers, where we have big galaxies eat little galaxies. And that happens typically when some of these subhalos fall into the Milky Way. They can produce... they can be absorbed, and they don't produce much of an effect, but what they is, as we saw in that picture where we saw that streak coming from the center, that's of the Sagittarius dwarf being eaten at the far side of the Milky Way, but it's falling into the disk. We've not seen yet other evidence of that. One of the things that has been a prime topic of the meeting that we held last week is that we're beginning to understand as the galaxies, the luminous galaxies fall in, they get tidally disrupted. And because they're stars, the stars will maintain their orbits for long periods of time, and we are now beginning to see evidence of these ghostly streams of satellites that have been tidally disrupted and tidally destroyed by their passage through the Milky Way and the Milky Way itself.
How do you get rid of the orbital angular momentum of a small galaxy that is made of dark matter and magnetic?
You can get some through, parts of it through tidal interactions and through interaction. The gas will naturally lose its angular momentum.
The dark matter?
Dark matter doesn't lose its angular momentum. I mean, there are other ways. There's things of dynamical friction. In other words, that if you have a small galaxy moving into regions of higher density, then it's like a ship going through the water. It leaves a wake of material, and that wake of material will cause it to lose angular momentum and spiral into the center. So there are lots of ways in which that happens. The degree to which it's important are things that we're trying to understand now and are coming mostly through simulations.
Radiate gravitons or?
Well, if that's, if that's your model, I guess, I guess so. Brandt, do you have?
If you just mean through the gravitational interaction, yes. But if you mean,
Okay, so it's not. But that's where we live in different communities, so it's okay. So there was one more point I wanted to make. And that is that we now have we can think about some sort of general understanding about the galaxies we looked at in the beginning. That is, that these giant elliptical galaxies that we see are galaxies that we believe have occurred mostly through what we talk about as major mergers. That is, major mergers, they probably occurred late, they had to eat a lot of galaxies, and these are places where the angular momentum of the two progenitor galaxies were at some arbitrary orientation with respect to others. And so when that happens, we know from the simulations, and you can even get this from some analytic calculations, that you expect these things to fall into some sort of spheroidal distribution, effectively destroying all memory of the galaxies out of which they formed, all but the grossest of the properties. The spiral galaxies have been eating smaller galaxies. They can have major mergers if the orbital angular momenta are lined up. The smaller galaxies are probably the smallest ones are the ones that are the least evolved. And what we find out, we can get some evidence of this evolution of the galaxies by looking at the abundances of the heavy elements, which can only be produced within stars themselves, and see how are these abundances, do the small galaxies tend to have smaller, lower abundances of heavy elements, and the answer is yes. And one of the questions that came up at our meeting last week is, can they produce, do they have metallicities or abundances that are capable of producing the halo of stars, which I didn't talk about very much in the Milky Way. There was some debate about that. I think the answer was yes, but.
How does a major merger get rid of the gas?
The major merger itself does not get rid of the gas. What it does is that it will, depending on the orientation of the galaxies, the gas will itself collide. The gas itself naturally forms into a disk, always. And the reason is because it does self-interact, and what happens is, let me be a spinning gas particle just all by myself, gas in a galaxy. The conservation of angular momentum means that it's very hard to get gas to move into or out of the center. But along my rotation axis, there's nothing to prevent it. So I can get collisions, I get between the gas particles and gas clouds. They'll excite and cool. And it's the cooling that becomes very, very important here. When I say cooling, it excites atomic molecular transitions that then radiate out. And so you've lost energy from the system, and therefore you can't support it as well. So you naturally fall into disk configuration from gas interactions. At precisely what happens, we'll ultimately think turns the gas into different phenomena in galaxies. If you lose all the angular momentum, it falls into the center, and there's evidence that we think that gas like that evolution produces starbursts. In other words, you get so much material into the center, it cools so rapidly that you get an enormous burst of star formation. And one of the topics that astronomers are looking at and thinking about now are, well, how do you get rid of the gas? In other words, we ultimately have to get rid of all that gas in these elliptical galaxies because we don't see very much. The answer is we don't know. But people who work on the subject think they know. And the reason they think they know is they give it a name. They call it feedback. What feedback means is once you form stars, some fraction of the stars produce supernova explosions, which are very energetic and drive the gas out. How does that work? Say that again?
Out of the galaxy?
Yes. In principle, it can. A typical escape velocity for a galaxy like the Milky Way is a few hundred kilometers per second. The supernova and sometimes stellar winds can accelerate gas to several thousand kilometers per second. So it can get out. But if some of my colleagues would tell me what feedback really is, I'd be much illuminated. So let me just, we are beginning to have a picture of the evolution of galaxies, and this is now my last point about what has happened to astronomy in the last decades. When I was a graduate student some years ago, the emphasis on what people were doing was completely different from what it is now. And that is that people were trying to understand phenomena. They were doing phenomenology. What are the physical processes? What are the underlying physical processes? There's a lot of work in atomic molecular astrophysics for the interstellar gas. There was a lot of work on dynamics, stellar dynamics, and trying to understand these processes. But we've gone beyond that. Because we have a general picture now, we think we do. We can talk about astronomy as natural history. That is, that we're trying to develop a picture of how the universe went from the Big Bang, from the Planck scale, ultimately, which is about as far back as we can go, up until now, and relate the things we see to this picture of a history of the universe, rather than simply phenomenology and physical processes. We need these, and in fact, to some degree, this has gone too much the other way, that there are some simulations that say, some aspect of simulations, which we talk about as semi-analytic modeling, that's the astronomical term. What that means is, I don't know what the physics is, but I'm going to parameterize it by a certain number. And I'm going to allow that number to change, to go up and down, and see how that changes the galaxies themselves. Now, there's a lot that has been learned from these methods, but ultimately, to get a true understanding of what's going on, we have to understand the physics, how the physics relates on different scales, on different time scales, and that's the process of discovery, I think, that's going on now in much of astrophysics, and certainly in this field of galaxy evolution. Thanks very much. Yes.
We heard a talk by Simon White not so long ago.
Did he say something completely different from what I'm saying?
Not about galaxies, but about the question is, as far as funding goes in astronomy, should astronomers advocate funding, for example, large projects like JDAM, Search After the Fundamental Physics, which are expensive, or should you fund smaller projects like more telescopes to study the phenomenology? And please don't answer both.
No. Well, I think when we have to ask ourselves the question, and you probably...
You're advocating small.
Yeah. The way I would approach that question is to ask, one JDEM, for example, say a $1 billion project, maybe more than that, how much can you do for $1 million doing other stuff?
Yeah, okay.
And it seems to me that there may be some questions will only be answerable by these huge projects like that, but there are many, many more that we get from the smaller projects. I'm an advocate of small to medium. For 20 years, well, for the last 12 years, I've just stepped down being director of the Radio Astronomy Lab at Berkeley. We had a budget of, well, the budget when I turned it over to my successor was about $7 million a year. Now, is that a big project? I think from the point of view of the theorists, the astrophysical theorists, that's a lot of money. But from the point of view of something like JDAM or Constellation X or any of these other huge space projects, it's a drop in the bucket. So when we say small, I think we have to understand that small encompasses a range. And if you want a billion-dollar project, you better be pretty damn sure it's going to be doing something so important as to wipe out a lot of the money that would be available for small projects.
Thank you. If I can just add something, a relatively small project called the Schlumberger Sky Survey,
yes,
in terms of cost, is one of the sort of highest cited science in our field.
Yeah, I mean, there is one other thing, and Sloan is a very, very good example. Sloan was originally costed at $8 million. Well, the final cost has been about $80 million. But the thing is that it was a project that allowed new things to happen, and as long as you can do that, in other words, make innovations, and the innovations become, especially for observational projects, instrumental. Like experiment, you know, our equivalent of experimental stuff, and this is in radio astronomy. The tradition is that you have to innovate. You have to innovate, otherwise, you sell all the metal for scrap, and that's what happens. And the radio astronomers have been pretty good about that. So. This range is important and it produces a lot, but even with Sloan, you have to be able to innovate, you have to be able to make the instrument better, and it's not just JDEM that is coming on, you know, that we're talking about, is that with the 20 to 30 meter telescope, which the University of California is heavily involved in, I don't care what the numbers say so far, that's a $1 billion project. Is it worth shutting down so many of the smaller telescopes for that project? I don't know.
ALMA,
right. Okay, as a radio astronomer, let me say that the same thing is true for ALMA. ALMA was very poorly designed. And it was our array and Caltech's millimeter array, which were the models for ALMA. ALMA has a tiny field of view. You see things a fraction of an arc minute in any one pixel, typically. And now it's eating the lunch. It's going to be eating the lunch of a lot of smaller projects. It could have been done differently. ALMA is the Atacama Large Millimeter Observatory. So it's what started out as 64 12-meter dishes on a high plateau in the Atacama Desert, it's a $600-700 million project. But I think that's the wrong way to think of these large projects. We have to think about the projects as encompassing operating costs, and a rough number for operating costs is 10% of the capital cost. So I mean, you can get, you know, we've been doing 7%, but for this kind of figuring, it's 10%. So what that means is that the ALMA telescope, the U.S. portion of it, which is about effectively half, say $300-350 million, it's going to cost $30 million a year to operate. $30 million a year is the size of the budget for all of the individual grants in the NSF grants program, and we don't know where that money's going to come from. Yes.
You mentioned the plot of velocity versus radius inside the galaxy.
Yes.
is indicative of there being more matter than we actually see.
Yes.
About a year ago, I think I heard on NPR that there are these Canadian physicists who believed you could explain this curve away by taking into account general relativity correctly. And that's the only thing I heard about this. What is the status of?
I think that's Frank Cooper's stuff, right?
Yeah.
He made a mistake.
Okay. I didn't check his work, but it has been since the beginning, modified Newtonian gravity, which was known at that time as by the acronym MOND, by looking at, you know, the argument being that small accelerations produce an additional Newtonian term, and that much of this stuff could be explained. I have to say that the proponents of this modified gravity have been very clever in being able to explain a lot, but it lacks, to my taste, and not being someone who does general relativity for a living, but from what my understanding of it, it lacks a certain underlying physical basis, some physical beauty that GR and our edifice of physics stands on.
MOND has essentially been ruled out by the Bullitt question.
Well, yeah, it certainly, the Bullitt cluster certainly makes MOND harder to swallow.
Fair enough.
So it's not a GR correction, it's a modification.
No.
Okay. And it's a modified theory.
It's a modified theory, yes.
This Canadian theory you're talking about.
I don't know in particular, but I think it's probably.
Yeah. Okay, this is not what I work on, so.
And it was just a mistake.
Yeah. Andrew, did you have a
question? Yeah, sorry, I feel like stick up with the semi-analytic models and stuff. What you described is the wrong way to do semi-analytic modeling of galaxy composition. I mean, if you treat it as a set of adjustable knobs and dials that you can play with, then it's difficult to learn much from. What these things are actually good for is taking, as you very nicely described, a sort of very complex array of different physics that determine how galaxies form, and putting that all together in a way that we can actually try to understand the interactions, which is sort of the crucial thing to my mind. And so, I mean, I agree with you. In the past, people have done this the wrong way, where they just say, well, let's throw in feedback and see what happens. But I think what we're moving towards is sort of a more physical description of a lot of these processes, and then it becomes a much more interesting game. But it's, yeah, I think there is a lot to be gained from it if you're using scaffolding based on physics and all.
I don't disagree with you, but I'll do anything for a laugh, Andrew, so.
So,
Jennifer.
I don't think you ever answered number five, the image of a star cluster and a galaxy. You're getting wrong.
It is. I just realized as we were talking about this, if I can just take one more minute here. And go back to the images of the galaxies and those last galaxies that couldn't be seen. Remember I talked about mass-to-light ratios. That is, that the mass-to-light ratio of the Milky Way is, of the disk of the Milky Way, the stars in the disk, is probably something like 3 to 5. Galaxies, including the Milky Way, including all the dark matter, is something like 30 or 50 or something like that. These galaxies, these particular galaxies, have mass-to-light ratios of about 1,000. That is, there's so much dark matter compared to the amount of luminous matter that it's hard to imagine how the gas in these galaxies could have, you know, had whatever sexual relations they had to be able to form stars to begin with. And this is, in fact, a significant puzzle that I think people will have to address. And so the question is, what is a galaxy? And one of the ways that we can begin to answer this is through this issue of dark matter. That is, when we look at globular clusters, those little clusters that I showed you near the Magellanic Cloud, these clusters, as far as we can tell, contain no dark matter. Individual star clusters, but whenever we see dark matter, the smaller the galaxy, the larger is this mass-to-light ratio. There are things that I've personally been looking for that probably don't seem to exist, that is, galaxies that have no stars whatsoever. And you know, we can talk about these as these dark matter nubbins in here that haven't formed stars yet at all, but it's possible, it's at least theoretically possible that these things may have captured enough atomic hydrogen, but that atomic hydrogen is too dilute to have formed stars. And we can look for that atomic hydrogen by means of radio telescopes, and we've been looking, but we haven't found anything yet. So at some point, what you call a galaxy, what you call a dark matter subhalo, we're moving the definition a little bit like we moved the definition of Pluto around a few years ago.
But what about star clusters?
Well, any star cluster that we've measured seems to contain no dark matter. In other words, the velocity dispersion of the stars is perfectly explainable in terms of the mass that we can see within the cluster.
Is the ratio of ordinary to dark matter sort of constant within galaxies, or might you have galaxies with somewhat less or somewhat more?
No, this was just my last point, in fact, that these newly discovered dwarf galaxies have 10 to 100 times as much dark matter per amount of luminous matter than the big galaxies do. We know what the universal ratio is. It's about probably, I think this number for stars will be about 2%, so it's about 10% on a universal basis, but there can be considerable variation with that, depending on the evolutionary state of the galaxy.
Just to clarify, that last comment was about the mass to light ratio as opposed to, say, the non-interacting dark matter to baryon ratio.
Well, when we talk about the mass to light ratio, we tend these days now to include all the mass, whether it's dark or not. Otherwise, we'll talk about luminous mass.
My question is, do you have an idea in these new, dim, high mass to light ratio galaxies, what's the ratio of, say, non-standard model dark matter to baryons? Or is that a...
Well, this is what we're saying, is they contain no gas, as far as we can tell.
No gas, okay.
So, you know, this ratio of about 1,000, you know, several hundred to 1,000 or even 2,000 is what we measure. That's the actual. Okay. Thank you.